The Famine. On the Assiniboine River in western Manitoba, there stands an old historic trading post whose crumbling walls crown a high promontory in the angle formed by its junction with a tributary stream. This is Fort Ellice, a mistress of the wilderness and lodestone of savage tribes between the years 1830 and 1870. Hither at that early day, the Indians brought their buffalo robes and beaver skins to exchange for merchandise, ammunition, and the spirit water. Among the others there presently appeared a band of renegade Sioux, the Exiles as they called themselves, under White Lodge, whose father, Little Crow, had been a leader in the outbreak of 1862. Now the great war chief was dead, and his people were prisoners or fugitives. The shrewd Scotch trader MacLeod soon discovered that the Sioux were skilled hunters, and therefore he exerted himself to befriend them, as well as to encourage a feeling of goodwill between them and the Canadian tribes who were accustomed to make the old fort their summer rendezvous. Now the autumn had come, after a long summer of feasts and dances, and the three tribes broke up and dispersed as usual in various directions. White Lodge had twin daughters, very handsome, whose ears had been kept burning with the proposal of many suitors, and none had received any definite encouragement. There were one or two who would have been quite willing to forsake their own tribes and follow the Exiles had they not feared too much the ridicule of the braves. Even Angus MacLeod, the trader's eldest son, had need of all his patience and caution, for he had never seen any woman he admired so much as a Bekant Magaskawi, called the Swan, one of these belles of the forest. The Sioux journeyed northward toward the Mouse River. They had wintered on the stream before, and it was then the feeding ground of large herds of buffalo. When it was discovered that their herds were moving westward across the Missouri, there was no little apprehension. The shrewd medicine man became aware of the situation and hastened to announce his prophecy. "The great mystery has appeared to me in a dream. He showed me men with haggard and thin faces. I interpret this to mean a scarcity of food during the winter." The chief called his counselors together and set before them the dream of the priest, whose prophecy, he said, was already being fulfilled, in part, by the westward movement of the buffalo. It was agreed that they should lay up all the dried meat they could obtain, but even for this they were too late. The storms were already at hand, and that winter was more severe than any that the old men could recall in their traditions. The braves killed all the small game for a wide circuit around the camp, but the buffalo had now crossed the river, and that country was not favorable for deer. The more enterprising young men organized hunting expeditions to various parts of the open prairie, but each time they returned with empty hands. The moon of sore eyes, or March, had come at last, and Wazia, the god of storm, was still angry. Their scant provision of dried meat had held out wonderfully, but it was now all but consumed. The Sioux had but little ammunition, and the snow was still so deep that it was impossible for them to move away to any other region in search of game. The worst was feared. Indeed, some of the children and feeble old people had already succumbed. White Lodge again called his men together in council, and it was determined to send a messenger to Fort Ellice to ask for relief. A young man called Face the Wind was chosen for his exceptional qualities of speed and endurance upon long journeys. The old medicine man, whose shrewd prophecy had gained for him the confidence of the people, now came forward. He had closely observed the appearance of the messenger selected and had taken note of the storm and distance. Accordingly, he said, "My children, the great mystery is offended, and this is the cause of all our suffering. I see a shadow hanging over our messenger, but I will pray to the Great Spirit. perhaps he may yet save him. Great mystery, be thou merciful. Strengthen this young man for his journey, that he may be able to finish it and to send us aid. If we see the sun of summer again, we will offer the choicest of our meats to thee and do thee great honor. During this invocation, as occasionally happens in March, a loud peal of thunder was heard. This coincidence threw the prophet almost into a frenzy, and the poor people were all of a tremble. Face the Wind believed that the prayer was directly answered, and though weakened by fasting and unfit for the task before him, he was encouraged to make the attempt. He set out on the following day at dawn, and on the third day staggered into the fort, looking like a specter and almost frightening the people. He was taken to MacLeod's house and given good care. The poor fellow, delirious with hunger, fancied himself engaged in mortal combat with Ea, the god of famine, who has a mouth extending from ear to ear. Wherever he goes, there is famine, for he swallows all that he sees, even whole nations. The legend has it that Ea fears nothing but the jingling of metal. So finally the dying man looked up into MacLeod's face and cried, "Ring your bell in his face, Wahaga." The kind-hearted factor could not refuse. And as the great bell used to mark the hours of work and of meals pealed out untimely upon the frosty air, the Indian started up and in that moment breathed his last. He had given no news, and MacLeod and his son could only guess at the state of affairs upon the Mouse River. While the men were in council with his father, Magaskawi had turned over the contents of her work bag. She had found a small roll of birch bark in which she kept her porcupine quills for embroidery and pulled the delicate layers apart. The White Swan was not altogether the untutored Indian maiden, for she had lived in the family of a missionary in the States and had learned both to speak and write some English. There was no ink, no pen or pencil, but with her bone awl, she pressed upon the white side of the bark the following words. "Mr. Angus MacLeod, we are near the hollow rock on the Mouse River. The buffalo went away across the Missouri, and our powder and shot are gone. We are starving. Goodbye if I don't see you again. Magaskawi." The girl entrusted this little note to her grandmother, and she in turn gave it to the messenger. But he, as we know, was unable to deliver it. "Angus, tell the boys to bury the poor fellow tomorrow. I dare say he brought us some news from White Lodge, but we have got to go to the Happy Hunting Grounds to get it, or wait until the exile band returns in the spring. Evidently," continued MacLeod, "he fell sick on the way, or else he was starving." This last suggestion horrified Angus. "I believe, father," he exclaimed, "that we ought to examine his bundle." A small oblong packet was brought forth from the dead man's belt and carefully unrolled. There were several pairs of moccasins, and within one of these, Angus found something wrapped up nicely. He proceeded to unwind the long strings of deerskin with which it was securely tied, and brought forth a thin sheet of birch bark. At first, there seemed to be nothing more, but a closer scrutiny revealed the impressions of the awl, and the bit of nature's parchment was brought nearer to his face and scanned with a zeal equal to that of any student of ancient hieroglyphics. "This tells the whole story, father," exclaimed the young man at last. "Magaskawi's note, just listen," and he read it aloud. "I shall start tomorrow. We can take enough provision and ammunition on two sleds, with six dogs to each. I shall want three good men to go with me." Angus spoke with decision. "Well, we can't afford to lose our best hunters, and you might also bring home with you what furs and robes they have on hand," was his father's prudent reply. "I don't care particularly for the skins," Angus declared, but he at once began hurried preparations for departure. In the meantime, Affairs grew daily more desperate in the exile village on the faraway Mouse River, and a sort of Indian hopelessness and resignation settled down upon the little community. There were few who really expected their messenger to reach the fort, or believe that even if he did so, relief would not be sent in time to save them. White Lodge, the father of his people, was determined to share with them the last mouthful of food. And every morning, Winona and Magaskawi went with scanty portions in their hands to those whose supply had entirely failed. On the outskirts of the camp, there dwelt an old woman with an orphan grandchild who had been denying herself for some time in order that the child might live longer. This poor teepee the girls visited often, and one on each side, they raised the exhausted woman and poured into her mouth the warm broth that they had brought with them. It was on the very day Face the Wind reached Fort Ellis that a young hunter who had ventured further from the camp than anyone else had the luck to bring down a solitary deer with his bow and arrow. In his weakness, he had reached camp very late, bearing the deer with the utmost difficulty upon his shoulders. It was instantly separated into as many pieces as there were lodges of the famishing Sioux. These delicious morsels were hastily cooked and eagerly devoured. But among so many, there was scarcely more than a mouthful to the share of each, and the brave youth himself did not receive enough to appease in the least his craving. On the eve of Angus's departure for the exile village, Three Stars, a devoted suitor of Winona's, accompanied by another Assiniboine brave, appeared unexpectedly at the fort. He at once asked permission to join the relief party, and they set out at daybreak. The lead dog was the old reliable Mac, who had been in service for several seasons on winter trips. All of the white men were clad in buckskin shirts and pantaloons, with long fringes down the sides, fur caps, and fur-lined moccasins. Their guns were fastened to the long, toboggan-like sleds. The snow had thawed a little and formed an icy crust, and over this fresh snow had fallen, which a northwest wind swept over the surface like ashes after a prairie fire. The sun appeared for a little time in the morning, but it seemed as if he were cutting short his course on account of the bleak day, and had protected himself with pale rings of fire. The dogs laid back their ears, drew in their tails, and struck into their customary trot. But even old Mac looked back frequently, as if reluctant to face such a prickling and scarifying wind. The men felt the cold still more keenly, although they had taken care to cover every bit of the face except one eye, and that was completely blinded at times by the granulated snow. The sun early retreated behind a wall of cloud, and the wind moaned and wailed like a living creature in anguish. At last they approached the creek, where they had planned to camp for the night. There was nothing to be seen but a few stunted willows half buried in the drifts, but the banks of the little stream afforded some protection from the wind. "Whoa!" shouted the leader, and all the dogs stopped, sitting down on their haunches. "Come, Mac," with a wave of the hand, "lead your fellows down to the creek." The old dog started down at the word, and all the rest followed. A space was quickly cleared of snow, while one man scoured the thickets in search of brush for fuel. In a few minutes, the tent was up, and a fire kindled in the center, while the floor was thickly strewn with twigs of willow, over which buffalo robes were spread. Three Stars attended to supper, and soon in the midst of the snapping willow fire, a kettle was boiling. All partook of strong tea, dried meat of buffalo, and pemmican, a mixture of pounded dried meat with wild cherries and melted fat. The dogs, to whom one half the tent was assigned, enjoyed a hearty meal and fell into a deep sleep, lying one against the other. After supper, Jerry drove two sticks into the ground, one on each side of the fire, and connected the two by a third one over the blaze. Upon this, all hung their socks to dry. most of them, merely square pieces of blanket, cut to serve that purpose. Soon each man rolled himself in his own buffalo robe and fell asleep. All night the wind raged. The lonely teepee now and then shuddered violently as a stronger blast than usual almost lifted it from the ground. No one stirred, except from time to time one of the dogs, who got up snarling and sniffing the cold air, turned himself round several times as if on a pivot, and finally lay down for another nap. In the morning, the travelers one by one raised their heads and looked through the smoke hole, then fell back again with a grunt. All the world appeared without form and void. Presently, however, the light of the sun was seen as if through a painted window, and by afternoon they were able to go on, the wind having partially subsided. This was only a taste of the weather encountered by the party on their unseasonable trip, but had it been 10 times harder, it would never have occurred to Angus to turn back. On the third day, the rescuers approached the camp of the exiles. There was an ominous quiet. No creature was to be seen. But the smoke which ascended into the air in perpendicular columns assured them that some, at least, were still alive. The party happened to reach the first teepee of the poor old woman who had been so faithfully ministered to by the twin sisters. They had no longer any food to give, but they had come to build her fire if she should have survived the night. At the very door of the lodge, they heard the jingle of dog bells, but they had not time to announce the joyful news before the men were in sight. And then Angus anxiously began looking around the camp, calling for McGaskalee. He feared the worst. Then slowly, people began to come out from their teepees, tired, thin, but smiling at the arrival of the rescue party. Angus and his men hurriedly began to unload the supplies, and jerked buffalo meat was immediately given to each person as they emerged. Suddenly, Angus felt a cold hand touch his shoulder. He turned around and looked straight in the deep, dark eyes of McGaskalee. When the summer sun was high in the sky, the festivities were beaming bright. The wedding of Angus and McGaskalee was heralded over the land in both the Indian and white man's camp, and to this day is called the Day of the Sun and the Moon.